and put it away.
Yeah, it's the biggest scam there ever was. Especially in a city with good water. California, I would think.
That's right, maybe that's the only source they have, right?
Or it's just so awful.
Yeah.
We're just down in L.A. Water's that water's really terrible. Yeah,
I think we have tasty water in my hometown in England, too.
I didn't have particularly tasty water growing up, but I didn't know the difference.
Yeah.
Like, once you taste the good stuff. I don't have the PowerPoint in my packet. I'm feeling deprived and unloved, but I don't know. I will. Okay, David, take it away, please.
Good afternoon. I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Portland Water Bureau, and I'm hoping you have our presentation in front of you, and you will be relieved to hear me say that despite the fact that we have 31 slides, I'm only going to hit, I think, 8 of them. And I will try and tell you where I am as I'm moving through it. So I'm going to move right to the third slide and talk about what are our priorities. They say right in front of you, excellent water, protecting the public health, providing water every hour, every day, firefighting emergencies. One of my predecessors, Ed Tenney, used to refer to it of good clean water and lots of it. Those are our priorities. Or one of the internal phrases we use is the four C's of water: clean, cold, cheap, and constant. All those things are our priorities, and that's what drives what we do. If you go to the next page, I'm going to talk a little bit about our performance measures, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the dashboard, and I'm not sure if we come back to that a little bit when we get to the CBO's piece. These are key performance measures. We have 27 other key service levels that we track, but these are basic performance measures, many of which are industry standards. The first one is the average time that customers are on hold, and our goal is 2 minutes. We are one of the issues we have with the dashboard concept is that it's a pretty universal red, bad, stop, caution, yellow, be careful, think about what you're doing, green, you're generally good to go. And in this case, we have a red arrow upward. And the reason why our red arrow is upward is because our average call time wait went from 90 seconds to 91 seconds over the course of 2 years. And we get 500 calls a day. So, you know, we think, one, yeah, technically it did go up, but it's not very significant. And two, it's significantly below our standard. 91 seconds is quite a bit below 120 seconds. Now, just so that you don't think that we're cheating and we've set an incredibly easy standard, the office or the Omaha Metropolitan Utility District has a standard of, they'd like to hit 3, they're at 9 right now. The LA Department of Water and Power is at 2 hours right now, and they have limited callback ability. So you can't even leave them a message that says, hey, I have a problem, I want you to call me back. And the last little bit I'll give you is that 6 of the 16 energy providers in the UK are able to meet their 2-minute standard of with 60 million calls a year. So we actually think we're doing pretty well here. The second one that I want to talk about is the number of unplanned events leading to customers out of service for more than 8 hours. And as a general rule, we do a pretty good job of that. You'll see a picture later on in my presentation about the one event that we had last year, the Burnside event, where we were out of water for 22 hours. It was a major main break. But as a general rule, we're doing a pretty good job on this. We have a standard of no more than 2. The percentage of high-risk assets addressed, that is, where are we looking at the highest risks that we have in our system, and are we addressing those? In general, we're doing a pretty good job. We have a standard of hitting at least 80% of those, and right now we're at 95, 96%. The number of violations of state and federal drinking water quality regulations. That's a pretty good standard. It should be zero. It is zero. We've had a couple of trips in the last couple of years that we consider to be one-off events, the boil water notice last year being the most obvious example of those. And then the number of violations of state and federal environmental regulations. Again, the trend is no change. Our goal is zero. We've had two in the last 2 years. One was where we had water going out of our new Powell Butte facility that put chlorinated water into Johnson Creek. That was an error on the part of our contractor. We fixed it. We haven't had it again. And the one before that was where we put rock along the bank and created a ramp to get a boat into the river in Bull Run. And you can't do that without asking permission, and we didn't ask permission. So, again, those are one-off events that I don't think we'll be seeing again. And then the last one is maintain the revenue bond credit rating that we have. We're a AAA rated agency. We're one of only a dozen or so in the country of water utilities that has a AAA bond rating. Our only objection to this particular dashboard is a blue dot means nothing to most people. So I would either like a green dot or a gold star, because you can't do better than what we're doing. You can't get better than AAA budget rating. And the idea behind the dashboard is to have the layperson, the citizen, be able to look at it and say, red, that's a problem. Yellow, what are they doing? Green, that looks like they're doing the right thing. So those are our comments. We had a great conversation with Ryan this week where my entire team yelled at him. And we got a lot of input back and forth, and we're going to continue working with the CBO's office. They've given us a lot of ideas about what to do in the future and improve these key performance indicators.
Before you go to the rest, I do just want to take this, and thank you for raising your concerns, and I just want to take 10 seconds to raise our response. When putting together dashboards, one of the challenges is whether you're measuring actuals or whether you're measuring against goals. And one of the things we ran into, being that this is the first year, is that a lot of bureaus don't actually have goals established yet. And so we made the decision, which we wanted to make on a consistent basis, to go ahead and measure those actuals. And we also talked about the issue of statistical significance, because a lot of these, and you've seen these in other dashboards, small changes are resulting in green or red arrows. Because statistical significance in some cases can be measured but not at all, it was decided, again, we wanted to be consistent across all bureaus. So while David's right, the red arrow is indicating a negative trend for a very small change, he will be glad next year when he reduces that by a second or two and gets the green arrow down, even though it will also not be statistically significant. As this process evolves, we will continue to look at these things, and I think one of the points they've raised, which is an excellent one and is in the future, is how do we show visually whether a bureau is going to achieve its target? And I think when we get to performance check-ins, that's going to be a key component of that. So whether or not the actual trend is going up or down, do we expect them to stay within target? Because that's also a key component. And hopefully the sheet that we hand out with all of these, and that is online, explains what a blue dot is, explains what the arrows are, and explains what those trends are. And so hopefully citizens who are reading this will have that key so they can tell.
And Andrew, maybe for a certain select set of indicators where you're so conspicuously best in class, in honor of David, there'll be like a little trophy.
Yeah, trophy or gold star.
Trophy, gold star works.
Actually, Commissioner, speaking of best in class indicators, I would like to see, and this might run afoul of your rule that we shouldn't have an indicator where the answer is always 100%, but I kind of wish we had information on like percentage of visitors to Portland who say that the water here tastes better than their water at home. Because I do think that the fact that we have water that tastes really good is a major city asset that we should celebrate and people should know about, because I actually think that might affect some people's location decisions.
Moving on to...
Can I just chime in here? So this is another dashboard that has two indicators where we're doing better than our target. So that gets me thinking about, okay, well, what do we really mean by target? Do we really want to get to two? Because then we can just say that we're perfect for this first indicator when we're actually doing better than that now. And the same thing's true for the percentage of high-risk assets addressed. I understand that the standards are across the industry, or at least the subset that we want to emulate, are actually doing worse than we are already doing, which sort of raises the question of, are we trying to get, are targets things that we're trying to get to? And if targets are worse than where we are, that's confusing, right? So I want to sort of raise that question to be considered as we move forward with key performance indicators.
And by the way, if I just note that Steve, you're reading my mind recently when Oregonian had a front page story in a series on the drought in Oregon. And, you know, the national news is the drought in California and all the water shortages. And I kind of felt bad about that because someone coming to Portland was reading about this tremendous drought without any sort of qualification that we had the Bull Run watershed with 19 billion gallons in reserve and a backup water supply that could give us up to 100 million gallons a day. And that it's one of our great assets is we've got this protected water supply.
Sorry.
But it wasn't quite clearly spelled out in the headline about drought in Oregon.
So I've been corrected about two things, or one thing. We take over 1,000 calls a day, not 500. I apologize. One thing that's important to note is when we had the billing crisis before my time, yay, we had at one point in the call center a big digital clock on the ceiling that everybody could see. You couldn't miss it when you walked into the room, and that was our hold times. We've gotten rid of that clock, because we've driven it down from that 10-minute and longer hold time to we're now under that 2-minute target. And if we start to drift up to that 2-minute, it's not a target. We're not trying to get there. But if we start to drift up there, we'll be looking at what are we doing? Do we need to look at more staff? Do we need to look at more and better options for our customers to pay and be able to do some of the things that they want to do online more than having to talk to our people in person.
I might suggest the introduction of the less than sign and greater than sign. I mean, you know, if it's less than 2, that's good. If it's greater than 80, that's good.
I'm moving on to slide 8. What do we do to support those priorities? So one of the things is to maintain and improve our system. 75% of our CPI is spent on what we call the 3 R's, replacement, rehabilitation, and repair. That's primarily distribution mains. It's hydrants, it's meters, it's services, a pump station. We're going to rebuild a major pump station, or build a new pump station starting this summer, the Fulton Pump Station. Actually, it's going to be called the Hannah Mason Pump Station, the first facility we've had named after a woman in our history, former wife of a mayor who owned the property that we're building on. The Greenleaf Pump Station, the Willamette River Crossing, which we've talked about, a major capital program, generator up at Headworks, facility security, the roads up at the Bull Run, the conduits, repairs, fleet equipment, and groundwater electrical supply. And we're continuing to use asset management. It's the industry standard in assessing our risks, analyzing the benefits and the costs, and weighing the alternatives to best maintain our system. If you go to 13. So what are our challenges? The aging pipes and facilities, that picture over on the left is what I referred to as the Burnside break, and that was the key performance measure where we had one outage of more than 8 hours, an unplanned outage of more than 8 hours. That one was around 22. It cost approximately $135,000 to fix this as an emergency measure, and over $500,000 in costs estimated for business and traffic disruptions. Regulations such as LT2, which we've talked with this group several times over the years. We have the Powell Butte facility online. We have the Kelly Butte facility online. We are working through the land use process for what's referred to as the Tabor disconnection project. And we're going to be starting work on the Washington Park Reservoir in the next year. In addition to meeting the LT2 regulations, we're also meeting risk, which is the other slide that you see up there. Those facilities are designed to to meet today's revised seismic standards and our understanding of what our risks are. In addition to that, we are working on strengthening what we refer to as our backbone, our transmission lines, the main lines that bring water to our customers, so that we can harden them as much as possible. We have hardened our facilities, our conduits. We have at least one conduit that's hardened all the way from Bull Run into Powell Butte. The Willamette River crossing is another good example. We have six active crossings under the Willamette River, or going over the Willamette River. Two of them are on the Ross Island Bridge. We do not expect the Ross Island Bridge to survive a major earthquake. Three of them in the central core are over 70 years old. One of them is 113 years old. The Willamette River crossing, while a very expensive project, is designed to make sure that we will be able to provide water to our customers on the west side. If we do not have that, and if we have the major earthquake that we expect to have, and the three conduits that we expect to fail, then it will be 6 months or longer for water to be on the west side of Portland. So that's where we're spending, what our challenges are. If we could go to slide 16.
David, I just want to interrupt there and say, the investments you're making in hardening the system to survive an earthquake, those are investments that are saving the city of the future. Because
absolutely,
if we don't have water after the earthquake, people will simply leave. The city will cease to exist. So these are among the most important investments we make.
Absolutely. This one of the things, for those of you who don't know, the Water Bureau helped in a major response to Hurricane Katrina by sending two groups of approximately 30 people and all of their associated equipment, backhoes, dump trucks, etc., to New Orleans in October and November of 2005 to help put the water system back together for New Orleans. So we've learned how important it is to have water in a big city. New Orleans was a ghost town when I was there in October 2005. Slide 16. So what are our resources? You can see what we've got. Just going to touch on a couple of things. Our major resources are our water sales revenue. Then, of course, bonds. Our rate stabilization account, we're going to use $2.2 million from that account this year. And the other revenues includes our capital revenue, so what we refer to as petition mains. When a developer wants to build a development, they have to pay for the mains to be put in, SDCs, interagency reimbursements, and that sort of thing. Then if we go to 18, so what do we do with that $211 million? Our operating budget is about $77 million. The general fund transfer is one thing that often grabs a lot of people's attention, and that consists of about $6 million in the utility license fee, about $4 million for the general fund overhead. So that's where we're paying for the services that we get from the CBO, the city council, the attorney's office, HR, payroll, accounting. All of those are paid through the general fund overhead, and then pension obligation bonds. Slide 22, what's driving our CIP? Risk mitigation, I've already talked about that a little bit. Public health protection, that's what we do. We are the first and foremost stop in making sure that we provide healthy water for our citizens. Waterborne illness and death is one of the leading causes. Waterborne disease is one of the leading cause of illness and death throughout the world. We do such a good job of it that you turn on the tap and you don't think twice about whether or not it's safe to drink. There are plenty of places in the world where that is just not the case. So public health protection is up at the top. Regulatory compliance, we've already talked about. I think you can pretty much go through that slide on your own. Let's go to the next slide and talk a little bit about how we're spending that CIP. The primary portions of the CIP, and we're shifting it actually more to maintaining and replacing our distribution system assets. The lion's share of our CIP is in the distribution. So the pipes, the valves, the hydrants, the mains, the meters, the pump stations, all of those fit into the distribution system, including the Willamette River Crossing. The other big ones are the transmission and terminal storage, primarily, although there's a little bit of Powell Butte in this upcoming next year, a little bit of Kelly Butte. It's primarily the Washington Park reservoir over the next 5 years that makes up such a big piece of that pie, and then the conduits. We have three large conduits that I can stand up in, 60-inch conduits that run about 25 miles each. So we have 75 miles of really big pipe. We have no idea what that pipe, what shape that pipe is in. We've had several breaks in my 10 years. I think we've had at least five, maybe six good-sized breaks where we've had to do emergency repairs on our conduits. It is our plan to start spending some time doing some assessment of those conduits and then strategically deciding how are we going to repair, replace, or rehabilitate those conduits. One of the things we did last year was a major break on the Washington County supply line, and we took advantage of that break to fix it on the outside and then put people on the inside, fix the inside, and then do a survey of a relatively short section, 800 or 900 feet. But in today's environment, safety environment, it's a very different process. You used to go down there, give a guy a skateboard, they'd go scooting down the pipe until you got to the end. You don't do that anymore. When we did it with on the Washington County supply line, we had the fire bureau there. We had their major trench rescue people there. We had OSHA there. We had a lot of people there to make sure that everything we were doing was safe. And we're learning how to do that since we haven't done it in so many years. I'm almost done. If you go to page 29, so what is the rate increase going to get us? We like this slide because it shows where we are. Our average customer is going to pay $31.61 a month for 500 cubic feet of water, and I'm supposed to know this off the top of my head, 3,750 gallons, I think. Oh, 3,748, sorry. I was a couple gallons off. So we want to get a sense. 100 cubic feet is 748 gallons, or 1 cubic foot is.
So where
the rate increase that we're proposing, a 7% rate increase, will amount to the equivalent of $31.61 for our average residential customer. And if you're interested in knowing what it would cost, like a Safeway or a Kentucky Fried Chicken or a dry cleaner, I have that information as well. But as Jim was saying earlier, we tend to focus on the single family customer. And then the very last slide is we sell water for 1.9 gallons for the penny. While that's gone up, it is still the best deal in town. You cannot get any other utility for as low a price as we provide water, and we deliver it right to the homeowner's tap. So that's the conclusion of my presentation there. I just want to touch bases on a couple of things. Our key decision packages, we have a very small one. We have two very small ones. One of them is converting the Bull Run Ranger to a permanent full-time position. We've already done that with the council, but when we were working on this with the CBO, we had some miscommunications, and we only created a limited term position. All we're doing here is converting it to a permanent second position. That person should already have started, and so now we have two full-time security officers whose job is solely to patrol in the Bull Run. And the second ad package is to request the additional funding necessary to fund the interagency with the CBO for the dedicated staffing that will be staffed to the Public Utility Board. And with that, I'm I guess I turn it over to you guys. Nope. Okay. So I think we're up for questions.
Yes, I do have a question. I was wondering, did you consider putting a cost measure on your dashboard for cost to the ratepayers?
We'd have to ask the CBO's office on that one. We've looked at various cost measures, and our own, we have, as I mentioned, 27 different service levels, and we look at costs in a couple of those levels, but the dashboard is really more from the CBO's office and, you know, thinking about what would work best. So I would say no, but... But you're looking at me like...
Well, I am. That characterization,
you're gonna throw it over,
that characterization is catching me a little by surprise. Because, again, the dashboard, we work with bureaus very closely. We certainly hope that from the bureau's perspective, what's on the dashboard is really important to your operations. I think Katie may be picking up on the fact that BES had a cost measure on their dashboard. And
I realized that I really liked seeing that on their dashboard. And what it told me when I looked at it as a citizen, a user of both of those services, is that I can see from your dashboard that you are very proud and have run a very high quality organization, but then that efficiency piece, I can't see it anywhere. So that when you see how much you pay for it, then you get a sense for both the quality and the efficiency.
And I think I heard some of the conversation that was going on, and if I'm correct, was that the measure that Jim was talking about, the percentage of median income?
Yeah.
Well, and it was so the EPA uses income. That same standard for water and sewer, 2%. We're at 0.5.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I would suggest that you share that information with us citizens. Yeah.
Because it does, we look very good compared to that.
Uh-huh. And I, you know, and Carl and I have been over here talking, and I keep thinking, I almost want to see the dollar amount. I mean, honestly, just because of how much it communicates. And because if you're somebody who doesn't have the median income, and you may not know what it is, but you know how much your rate is. And so, and then if you somehow had a target that was to either to lower that or to at least keep it within a certain amount, that would communicate a lot to people that use your service.
I think this broader issue of how we communicate water and sewer and stormwater issues is spot on. I mean, you know, we had our rate hearing review a couple months ago. A citizen who came and testified began by asking, you know, what's the split between water and sewer on her bill? And we often hear from people who say, my water bill is too high. And the first thing we tell them, actually, your water bill is, your bill is one-third water, two-thirds sewer. So you're really upset. Call me back as the sewer commissioner, and we can talk about it. But we have to do a better job of explaining, how the bill is put together, what it pays, what it compares to, mm-hmm. compared to what, as Henny Youngman would say. I mean, all those things, we have to do a better job. And I'm hoping that when each of you that are here today sign up for monthly billing online, if you do that, I'm hoping that we will be able to send you better targeted information electronically that describes what you're paying for, what the value is, and give you other indicators, including give you a little warning notice if your water spikes and you weren't aware that maybe there's a leak in your system or something. So we think we can do a better job explaining the whole utility business to our customers, but it's very complicated. I'd settle just for getting clear that one third is water, two thirds is sewer, stormwater, and then building from there.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to get that in there.
I receive, as I expect many citizens do, the water bureau letter thing that comes in the mail, and I read it with great interest.
The bill stuffer?
Yeah. The annual report.
Ah, okay.
Talking about, yeah.
And get the card telling you to go online to get the annual report.
Right. Okay. Well, I look forward to that. But I was wondering if there's any plans to do something equivalent for sewer, because I've never seen anything like that for sewer.
There is.
Well, is there an equivalent?
The reason why we send out the water quality report is because it's a federal mandate. Uh-huh. I don't know that there's a similar, I suspect there isn't a similar mandate for
Well, we do have a irregular Clean Rivers publication that goes out, and what we're, you know, since our also we're trying to reduce paper usage, you know, the more communications we have with people that are electronic and not with paper, the more information we can offer them, a menu of options, and from both bureaus explaining what we do. And my sense is, and we keep hearing from various survey work, that what people really want to know is, am I getting good value? The media tends to harp on price. The public tells us they want value. And to make the value proposition, we have to do a better job explaining what are we providing them? How does our rate correlate to what we're providing? And then how does that compare to if you choose to move to Lake Oswego or Tualatin or Gresham, would you pay more or less? I think we can always do a better job explaining that.
Do we have, this may be a wild thought, but do we have any interconnections available that we could provide water to southeastern Oregon, to northern California, if we had to? None.
No, the former head of Northern Las Vegas Water Authority, Pat Mulroy, wanted to build a pipeline that would hook into the Columbia, but the cost of that is so incredibly prohibitive that it's just never happened. The closest we have in interconnections are to Clackamas River Water, Sunnyside Water, Milwaukee, that sort of thing.
Is there another way to ship it, David? I mean, for example, could you... California has a drought. Could we ship it by rail? Or
10 years ago, I talked to some representatives from China who wanted to just pull up to our South Shore well fields and fill a freighter full of water and take it back to China. And they came to the conclusion that, again, that wasn't, it was just not, there's just not the economy of scale. They've talked about bladders, huge ocean-going bladders that you can tow. And again, they just... That's just too expensive to make it worthwhile.
So, yeah, it's real expensive, but I guess if it was real imperative, that would be an option that could be looked at, I guess, the bladder.
We'd sell them the water.
At some point, you're competing with desalinization, too, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is whether the price point is above or below the economy of scale you can get. Yeah.
We would love to sell more water because, as David constantly reminds me, that the cleanest way for us to lower rates or stabilize rates is to actually sell more water. So if we could do it, even if it wasn't in a cost-effective way, we'd let the customer decide that. It would be good for the system.
The other concern in the public's always been that if we sell water to Californians, they might not move here.
Okay, now...
37 million of them down there without water. 1% decided to move to Portland.
Here I have to bring up one of the best signs at a basketball game I've ever seen. It was during a Blazer game. They were playing the Lakers. Somebody had a sign that said, "You aren't getting any of our water either."
So I have a question on page 28 of the handout, the five-year forecasted rate. Two questions. First is, what's the bump in 2018 for the five-year capital program?
$25 million jump there.
Let me look. I'm going to say it's probably a combination of Willamette River Crossing and the Washington Park. What year did you ask me, Commissioner?
2018, please. Those were my guesses.
We're anticipating spending $22 million on Washington Park Reservoir and almost $35 million on the Willamette River Crossing that year.
And the rate forecast is at 9.4 the year before that, and we do a bond issuance. Is that in anticipation of doing those projects?
Partly. We are selling bonds in general every 2 years, and we time the bond sale for the around the time when the proceeds from the previous bond sale have been spent.
Right.
So it's a timing issue. So that will be sooner or it might be later, depending on how we're working our way through the current bond proceeds.
So is there a way to smooth out the rate forecast so that there isn't that jump in 2017. Could we pay 8% across the board instead of going from 7% to 9.4 to 9.4 and then back again, or whatever the numbers would work out to be?
There are ways. I mean, we have our rate stabilization reserve. But what typically would happen is that if you use more of the reserve earlier, then you've run out of that reserve later, and your rate will be a little higher then.
But what if we put up the rate to 8% in 2016? We would presumably have then more than we needed for that year, and we could use some of the money left for the next year.
Approaches like that are an option.
Can I just throw one caveat into this? And Commissioner, you've noted this in the past. When you look at the five-year forecast for BES, the forecast to actual rate is very close and has historically been so. When you look at the five-year forecast for water and the actual, there's a much bigger delta. And so these are forecast numbers. Like, for example, this year, Celia, the forecast for this year was originally, 14. Pardon me?
14.
And we got it down to?
7% rate increase.
7%. So one of the questions that I've asked both bureaus to look at is to have a little more consistency in doing forecasting, and maybe look at BES's forecasting, which tends to be closer to the actual, and ask the question, why is it a bigger gap in the water? And you know, some of this is variables. It's interest rate, it's labor costs, it's things that you can't anticipate. But some of them may be explained by water being perhaps more conservative in how they do their forecasting. And as you know, Commissioner, what happens is you put out the scary numbers on the forecast, and that's what people focus on, not the actual. The reason that we're coming in this year below 5% for the second year in a row is we've brought the forecast down, but not necessarily by doing violence to the system. We've just taken advantage of historically low interest rates and lower labor
and
costs, other things.
I would say we're also sort of at the mercy of Jonas, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. Our bond, when we were anticipating a 14% rate increase at this time last year, we had a 6% bond sale assumption in our forecast. We sold bonds at 3.2%. That made a huge difference. So when you look at our assumption for 2017, you see 6%. And as we get closer to that, Jonas works with us, and we lower that projection, we lower that projection, we lower that projection, and eventually we sell the bonds. And I can tell you today, especially since I won't be here, that we are going to sell it for less than 6%. I can make that prediction because I can't be fired for missing it, because I'll be gone by then. But that takes that into account.
Well, I was actually thinking of hoping that I might be here in 2017 and thinking that it's a lot bigger increase than the previous year.
Right.
Is there a way to...
Well, I think
your point
is very well taken. And so the two questions we'll take up are, how can we get the forecast to actual closer? Because, again, public tends to look at the forecast, and those numbers tend to be scarier. And then and look at how that both bureaus do it, because BES, which has a much bigger budget, tends to be much closer to the actual. And second, how can we maybe smooth out the rates so there aren't any bumps? And there are trade-offs. And some of those trade-offs in the past were things the council subsequently frowned on, like deferring things that we shouldn't defer.
I'm not. In fact, I was thinking maybe move some of them up.
Yeah, but we will look at both, Commissioner, because I think you make a good point.
And one of the reasons why BES is closer is because a 1% swing for them is a huge amount, and a 1% swing for us is a much smaller amount. I mean, it is that one-third to two-third relationship that you were talking about earlier, Commissioner.
I'd just like to note for our viewers that I take it from Commissioner Fritz's willingness to have rates go up more in the next couple of years than in the previous succeeding years is that she's feeling pretty confident about her reelection in 2016, but she's expecting to do something in between 2016 and 2020 that might make things more difficult.
Wise choice. Anything else, David, that you need to add, or that we have other questions for David? And I want to get Janice.
Could you take a moment to acknowledge the team behind you?
Do I have to name them?
We like to acknowledge the senior folks.
Yeah, my minions, as I referred to them earlier in the week. The sub-minions are over there. So I do have most of my management team is here today. Chris Warner, our operations director, is out. But otherwise, you do have, we are surrounded by the team. So I have Susan Bailey, Ty Kovach, Mike Stewart, I'm going to see if I do this right, Eddie Campbell, Jamie Cuddy, Kathy Cook, Jeff Winter, and Jeff Layton, Jeff Winter, the Jeffs. They are an awesome group of people. They are the people who actually make this place run. And I'm sorry Chris isn't here. He's actually out working at a conference regarding seismic resilience and preparedness. And he's the guy who makes sure that the water does get delivered to our taps on a daily basis and that you can drink it.
Report for us.
Just a very quick note, highlighting, as has been mentioned, that the projections come in high, they do come down, so it's great to see that. But to follow up from the previous conversation with where there were some specific CUB BES recommendations related to cost recovery with some fees and nudging back up to the fully allowed amount of the sanitary sewer SDCs. I checked with Cecilia, and those issues are not applicable on the water side. I think their permit processes, for a variety of reasons, are maybe just not as involved as, I think BES does more of that kind of stuff, so there's probably more opportunities for shortfalls to start to occur, but just as I got help from BES on evaluating that situation for them, I checked with water, and there's no applicable or comparable opportunities there. And so they are charging what is fully allowed under state law related to the SDCs and are feel good about their cost recovery on the permits that they do charge for. So just to round out that picture.
And Dante, anything else from your review or CBO?
Just a quick comment to acknowledge that in the last couple of rounds of hiring through the apprentice process, that it's been the most diverse group of hires that I think water has seen in the last number of years. Mm. So kudos to that. And then second, I know that there's the low-income discount program. And so in conversations that I've had with David and some others, I think it's important to be able to not just say we give water to everybody, but also know who doesn't get our water and or where geographically. Maybe there are shutoffs, there are folks who are using the program more, or are we getting the information out in the way that we best can? And so I think being able to disaggregate some of that so that we know where there are, in fact, problems geographically or what communities are impacted is something that we need to continue to work on.
Mm, okay.
David, you have some data, right?
I do. I'm so glad you I'm so glad you asked. Because we're very proud of this. So we did a utility worker apprentice hire. They are the people that come in that we train to become our people in the field. So if you come in as a utility worker apprentice, you will eventually have the opportunity to become an equipment operator, a truck driver, a backhoe operator, a crew leader, a supervisor, a manager. Every single one of those people have all started in the Water Bureau as a utility worker. So the utility worker apprentice is our gateway into employment for a 30-year career. People do not leave the Water Bureau to transfer to another bureau. They retire from the Water Bureau. So in our last round of hires in June, We hired 12 utility worker apprentices. 5 were persons of color, 2 were women, 2 were vets. One of those vets was a person of color. So 8 of our 12 hires met our diversity goals. Now, we just finished, Ty's group just finished hiring for the crew leaders, the maintenance mechanic apprentices. So those are the people that are the people that are leading the crew that you see out in the field. And we just hired 8. 5 of them were persons of color, and 1 of them was a vet. So we're doing, you know, we're working our way up so that more and more of our employees look more and more like our community.
That's great. Good work.
Only just one thing to add. One of the reasons why we have such fun and robust conversations with water is that David is unique among bureau directors in his transparency, and he invites the CBO analysts to his senior management team meetings. They pretty much share information completely and openly, and so I would just actually thank him for that, and hopefully his successor will take the same approach. It certainly makes our job considerably easier and leads to a lot of fun give and take.
I'm not sure Ryan felt that way.
Other questions, comments, follow-up needed for you? Great. Please, Commissioner.
I want to publicly acknowledge and thank the folks who worked on the PERB for all their many years of service. This will be the last budget cycle in which the PERB plays an official role. I want to thank Ryan and the team at CBO for the partnership. This is David's last appearance at a budget forum of this kind. He has
you hope
he has announced his retirement, but he's also agreed to stay on a little longer if necessary to facilitate a transition. And we are extremely grateful for 37 years of service, 10 years at the helm of the Water Bureau, and he will be greatly missed, Mayor. And finally, just a heads up, particularly for our citizen advisors, we hope to have the legal framework to council in late April, early May, for debate and action on creating this new oversight body. So there's a team working on translating the recommendations into actually the ordinance that the council would then review and hopefully approve. Hope to have that late April, early May. We'll then go through a process of recruiting members to serve on this body, and the commitment that the mayor and I have made is that this new pub will be operational for the next budget cycle. So it'll be flying at 30,000 feet and working out all the details, but it'll be in connection with our next budget cycle. So stay tuned.
Well, thank you all very much. We're done with this stage of the process.
We are indeed.
Good. Thank you. Thanks, Wilson.
Yep. Thank you very much.